This is Central Time. Now, does it feel like there aren't enough hours in a day to do all the stuff you need to do or want to do? Well, maybe you could try a technique called time blocking. In short, you use a calendar, divide your day into chunks of time, color-coded, then do certain related tasks in a particular block. Advocates say it's a much better method than making those to-do lists. Now, this isn't new. It's been around for decades, time blocking. But thanks to younger people on the social media, especially video sharing platform TikTok, it's getting a fresh new look. The hashtag time blocking turns up 4.6 million views. Experts say when you do it right, it can help you make you more productive and reduce stress and anxiety. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel often like your schedule's too busy? You have a hard time keeping up with it? Have you tried one method, five methods to get it under control? Has anything worked for you? Have you tried this time-blocking thing? How did it go for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tim Pitchell is an associate professor of psychology at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario. He's the author of Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, a concise guide to strategies for change. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, Rob. I'm a big fan of public radio, and it's nice to be here when you're asking for support. I do the same for my local area.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you so much. Now this time blocking, can you tell us a little more about how it works, at least in theory?
Well, good. I'm glad you've said so much of it already, and that was an important point, at least in theory. You know, time blocking is a time management technique, as you said. You divide your day into blocks of time, and this is a key part. You have to set priorities and then put those priorities into those blocks of time. Now, the good thing about it, and I heard you say the same thing here, is that plans, and this is a form of planning, gives you a sense of control, so it reduces stress. But more importantly, and I think this is why people are attracted to it, plans have motivational force. So rather than just having a to-do list, by putting it into a time of the day, it's starting to create a plan that might get you moving. But I have to add this, is that one of my favorite sayings is that, you know, although all procrastination is delay, not all delay is procrastination. and with that goes the idea that, you know, time management is necessary but not sufficient, right? If this was the solution, it'd be like if libraries would be the solution to education, right? And so it's a good technique, but technique alone will sometimes fall short for us.
Yeah, I want to get into the motivation a little more in a bit, but just staying with the technique for a moment, someone might block a half hour of their day as this is answer email time, or this 2 hours is catch up on writing my reports, whatever the job is. And it could also be something fun outside of the workday. What sounds good about that to me about that, Tim, is otherwise that half hour might have been multitasking. I answer an email, I make a phone call, I type 5 words in my report. And that just seems like a, I don't know, when I do it, and I do it all the time, it seems like an inefficient way to get things done.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Adam Ghazali, amazing neuroscientist and physician, written a great book called The Distracted Mind. And he's advocating for single tasking because we have this myth of multitasking. And when we just kind of go in that desultory way here, there, and everywhere, we pay a big cost for that. So with an approach like we're talking about today, you can see more single tasking, and that is conducive to deep work. So you really get into something. And also, it develops a real awareness. One of the reasons I do it, I'm a big fan of it, by the way, as much as I said it's necessary, not sufficient, I really believe it is a great approach to go. And one of that is it just builds awareness of how you are spending your time. And because I color code it, I can glance at any week, and I can do this back to 2004 in my calendar, in fact, and I can tell you basically how I spent my time. And I put it all in there, and I do it proactively and retroactively because it makes me really accountable for my time and what we do, our actions, define in many ways who we are.
I wonder, my job as a radio host, my day is pretty predictable, so I could do this. My old job as a radio producer, our current producer, is very unpredictable. You might book a guest in 10 seconds, you might book a guest in 10 days, and you can't always predict the workflow. How do we account for that in a system like time blocking?
Well, this is really good because, you know, you talked about it feels good to maybe have this block of time for email. But, of course, not every profession is going to allow that. We call these environmental affordances. You actually have to have a job that provides that. And it's the same with some people even go so far as to what they call day theme. So this is a day I do planning, and this is the day that I do writing. you know, it sounds good in principle, but it has to fit the ecology of your life, that affordance. So you could still end up doing time blocking, but not necessarily within parts of your workday. You would know that before everyone goes on air, things are chaotic and all I can do is time block that I'm doing my production work. So you're absolutely right. This only works in parts of your day or in your career if you have a lot of autonomy for what you're doing next.
Now, you mentioned a plan like time blocking or any other time management system you say is necessary but not sufficient. I think I can vouch for that. I've made lots of great plans in my life that I didn't maintain like you did for 17 years. How do we get past, you know, that initial plan and get in the right frame of mind to where we actually use it to make our lives better?
Well, as your listeners heard, what I study is procrastination. And so I know the procrastinator's song. So you could set your day up for tomorrow and at 10 o'clock it says it's blocked off time for X, Y, or Z. And your whole body screams, I don't want to. I don't feel like it. I'll feel more like it tomorrow. There's the lyrics of the song. And so what we recognize in doing this research is that procrastination isn't a time management thing. It's necessary but not sufficient in the sense that you have to be able to regulate your emotions as well, so that when you get to that 10 a.m., you can downregulate negative emotions you have and get started. Now, there's other ways to get started too, but that's key right there.
We're talking about a time management practice known as time blocking. It's been around for quite a while, catching on social media. It can help us be more productive if we back it up by checking our motivation, our guest says. Tim Pitchell is our guest, associate professor of psychology at Carleton University in Ontario, author of Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done this? Have you used this time blocking to manage your day or maybe just your work day to try to keep organized, be more productive? Did it work for you? How do you do it? If you've had some other system, do magical to-do lists work for you? Or do you just have the satisfaction of crossing the little stuff off the list, but still never get to the big stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the resurgence of time blocking. It's a time management system. It's been around for years, gotten popular again with younger people on social media, especially TikTok. Instead of a to-do list, you use a calendar to divide your day into chunks of time. Supporters say it makes people more productive, helps them feel less stressed. Tim Pitchell is associate professor of psychology at Carleton University in Ontario. He wrote the book Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Have you done this time blocking in your work life, your daily life? Do you have another system? Have you tried lots of things and nothing works for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tim, I wanted to ask you about that stress angle. Why could, say, procrastinating, not getting something done and not having a system or a plan to get things done, why can that add to our stress and or anxiety?
Well, you know, we have a gap between intention and action. And so the moment we get that gap, we develop something we call dissonance, cognitive dissonance to be exact. But everyone knows dissonance in terms of music, two notes that don't sound good together. So in terms of our actions not meeting our intentions, it creates stress for us. And in fact, guilt is the biggest emotion we experience when we have procrastination. So it really is a wonderful tool to reduce stress, but sometimes it's a bit of a facade too. Sometimes we'll do all this planning, let's say on Monday, and then we say, well, but my planner doesn't say I start until tomorrow, right? All we're trying to do is downregulate our stress at that point. So you have to be aware that any of these techniques can be used in a bit of a self-deception dance as well.
Now, you've used time blocking, as you say, for quite some time. How did you find yourself on a practical level fine-tuning it, realizing you didn't need 3 hours for A, but you needed more than an hour for B, say?
Oh, that's such an important point. Like, I have really fine-tuned things, and I become very aware of how things fit better together, and so that you have your morning routine. And so some things would fit well in there and some things wouldn't, and you'd have to work to make those things fit. But just by keeping track, doing that audit, you can see that I'm constantly overestimating how much time I have horses where I live, how much time it takes to me to do my horse chores. So I shorten that down a little bit, or I see how I can get better efficiencies, quite frankly, too. So it can be a real productivity tool that way. But I believe so strongly in it. That's why I did some of the interviews I have, that although my research is on procrastination, and I'm always saying it's not a time management problem, I'm also saying to people, but you do have to know how to manage your time effectively. And on that note, too, I have to say that you have to be flexible. You have to be able to make intention updates as well. So that, for example, you wanted me to appear today at this time. Well, that meant something moved in my time block, but I can do that because I keep up with things.
Well, thanks for doing that. I appreciate it. Now, I'm thinking of this as a work thing. Can it be like a downtime thing, too? Could I time block, like, this is my fiction reading time or something like that?
Absolutely. I have my time blocks for everything from the moment I open my eyes to when I shut them.
Okay.
And now, you know, part of this, too, is a personality fit, too, because I can see some people just shaking their heads, right? So that some of us really like that structure more than others. But you can do it for your whole day, but I have to tell you that I have read widely on what people, the do's and don'ts of these things, and some people would say, well, don't overschedule your downtime. So you might just hold it as a big block of recreation time, but not put in everything that you're going to do, unless, of course, you want to do this forensic audit of what have I been reading, what have I been doing for exercise, that sort of thing. And that's where it gets down to a really specific level of fit, but you'll know if it works for you because it can be life-changing.
Now, here's what I imagine has got to be a roadblock for a lot of people that might not have been there 20 years ago. Social media or other things we can look at on our phone makes it really easy to procrastinate, and it can blow up those time blocks really quick, I imagine.
Oh, for sure. And this is why I went right to Adam Gazzelli, when I first talked about, you know, this distracted mind. And he talks a lot about these new technologies, right? We're like squirrels foraging in trees, and the next tree's full of nuts. And as he says, and that tree is really just a tab or another screen on your phone or your computer. So absolutely, we can amuse ourselves to death, as Neil Postman wrote in the 1990s. And we're living it in spades now in our world with really sticky technologies. So my big motto is you have to preempt that which tempts. If you want to be able to single task and do that deep work of this block of time, you don't keep your phone next to you. You don't have your messages coming through. You have to guard against that.
Now, people out there might be thinking, okay, I want to try this time blocking when I get around to it. How do we stop procrastinating and make our first plan and our first attempt at this?
Honestly, the magical saying I always start my day with and whenever I falter is, what's the next action? I know you don't want to do this right now, and you're even a little bit overwhelmed, but what's the next action you would take if you were going to do that? And keep that action as small as possible, because our motivation typically follows our action, not the other way around. So if you can just find that low threshold action to get started on, once you're started, you got the job half done. So try to keep that as a mantra in your mind. What's the next action? Some days when you're having a bad day, you might have to say that to yourself 100 times. Other days you say it once and you're off to the races.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for making time in your day for us.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Rob. And good luck with your fundraising. It's so important that we support public radio.
Thank you. That's Tim Bitchell, Associate Professor of Psychology at Carleton University in Ontario, author of the book Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, A Concise Guide to Strategies for Change. We talked to him about how time blocking can help make us more productive and why the decades-old time management concept is becoming popular with younger people. After first being reported in southern Africa last week, the Omicron variant of COVID-19 is now showing up in Europe, Australia, Hong Kong, Japan, and Canada. Researchers are trying to learn as much as possible about the new variant, with questions about how contagious it is, whether there's any difference in severity of infection, and whether vaccinations or past infections will offer less protection. In an effort to limit the virus's spread, some governments, including the U.S., have banned travelers from South Africa and nearby countries. Yesterday, President Biden says those restrictions won't stop Omicron from entering the U.S., but could help give us time to prepare.
This variant is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. We have the best vaccine in the world, the best medicines, the best scientists, and we're learning more every single day. And we'll fight this variant with scientific and knowledgeable actions and speed, not chaos and confusion.
Dr. Bill Hartman is an assistant professor of anesthesiology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and medical director of the UW Health Pre-Op Clinic. He's also principal investigator of the pediatric and adult vaccine trials at UW Health. Dr. Hartman, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, a lot of open questions still about the Omicron variant. What, from your vantage, what are you watching for in particular?
Well, the main things that we're concerned about, number one, how contagious is this? Is it increased in infectivity compared to the other variants like Delta? Number two, what's the severity of disease that it will cause? Is it milder or is it worse than what we've seen with variants such as Delta? And then the last thing is, how do our current treatments and vaccines affect this Omicron variant? And are they going to be effective in treating it or in preventing people from getting sick from Omicron?
We'll spend a lot of our time digging into those questions and how we're going to figure out answers to them. Before we get there, though, Dr. Harbin, I wanted to ask, what is different about this variant, just to, in terms of its form? What makes it stand out from the other variants we know so far?
I think the alarming thing about Omicron is the number of mutations that are within the genetic code for this variant. About 30 or so of these mutations are in the spike protein itself, which is the area of focus for most of our treatments and for the vaccines. And so that comprises probably about 5% of that spike protein. And is that enough to affect the immune response generated by the vaccines or to be treated by the monoclonal antibodies? Those are very, very important things for us to figure out here. And that's what's most concerning, though, about this particular variant and why it's grabbed the attention of the world.
How and why do mutations of a virus, especially a coronavirus, happen?
Well, the coronavirus itself is very apt to mutations. It wants to survive. These viruses are like any other living thing, and they want to survive, and they want to figure out how they can survive in populations. And so over time, what you'll see is that these viruses figure out ways to increase their transmissibility or their contagiousness, if you will. But at the same time, they may produce milder disease because they don't want to kill off their hosts. They can only survive if they have living hosts. And so this could be something that we're beginning to see with this particular variant, where it would be very transmissible, able to infect a lot of people, but hopefully the result or the severity of the disease is less than what we've seen with variants such as Delta.
One thing that strikes me is this is an amazing tool we have now, that we've got countries on the around the world doing this genetic monitoring and able, as scientists and public health people in South Africa did, being able to throw the caution flag up for the rest of the world. Humankind has not had this tool up till, the last couple of years, really, right?
Right. And, you know, a lot of credit has to go to South Africa for getting this information out to the world. What they had seen was that at a particular university, there was an outbreak of cases, and they assumed that this was going to be just another Delta outbreak. But they decided to go ahead and sequence this virus from a couple of these students, and they found that it had all of these mutations and that this wasn't Delta, that this was something else. And so they sequenced the entire genome to make it available to everybody throughout the world, and then let the world know that this virus mutation, that this variant is out there, and people needed to be aware of it.
Talking to Dr. Bill Hartman from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at what we know and don't know about the Omicron variant of COVID, or the virus that causes COVID-19. Dr. Hartman, looking at the big three questions now. Transmissibility, what are we watching for? What do we need to know if this does, in fact, spread faster than, say, the Delta variant?
Well, two of the mutations within that spike protein have been associated with other variants that have shown increased in transmissibility of the virus. And so we do suspect with both of these mutations present here, along with some others, that this virus will have the ability to greatly accelerate its transmission, even faster than Delta is what's expected. But some of the interesting things about the manifestations of this virus, though, are that the people that have caught this particular variant haven't lost their taste or smell like previous variants have caused. The disease seems to be somewhat milder. It's too early to tell if that's going to be the reality of it, but that's the trend that's been seen to this point. And so the fact that it's acting a little bit differently, and the fact that it's got these mutations that accelerate its transmissibility, these are things we really just need to keep an eye on and to get more information about.
So you talked about transmissibility, the severity we're still watching as it hits different populations. Now, how about what it means for the impact of vaccines people have already had or people have already had cases of the earlier strains of coronavirus? What are we watching for there in terms of the protection against this variant?
Well, it's too early to tell exactly what effect these mutations will have on the immune response generated by our vaccines. It's important to remember that about 95% of this spike protein is remaining the same, similar to what was seen in the original Wuhan version of COVID-19. And so I do suspect that our vaccines are going to still be very effective in preventing severe disease, hospitalizations, and death overall. But are they going to be as effective at preventing COVID-19 infection as they have been? And that's difficult to say right now, but I do anticipate that there is going to be reduced effectiveness overall.
I want to talk about what, if anything, this all means for our behavior, choices we make. First of all, when it comes to getting vaccinated, for people with no vaccines, first of all, can you start with what you are recommending for them?
Well, the best way we have to fight COVID-19 is to become vaccinated. And so if you haven't had your initial series of vaccines yet, absolutely get that vaccine. We're still fighting the Delta variant here in the United States, and 99% of our cases here in Wisconsin are with this Delta variant. The Delta variant itself is very effective in terms of getting out to people who don't have immunity. And so the immunity generated by vaccines is very protective, especially against the worst things that can happen from COVID-19. And so absolutely get that vaccine if you haven't had it yet. The other thing that we should remember is that boosters are now available for everyone over the age of 18. And so if you're more than 6 months out from your mRNA vaccine, Pfizer or Moderna, or more than 2 months out from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, then you're eligible to get a booster. The boosters are restoring the effectiveness of these vaccines back up into that 95-96 percentile. And so they're very effective and very important way of limiting the number of cases of COVID-19 that we're going to see in our state and in our country.
In just our last few moments, Dr. Hartman, what are you watching for next, especially here in Wisconsin?
Well, the number one thing that we want, especially as the weather gets colder and as people are doing more activities inside, is to get that vaccine. Because last year around this time is when cases really began to spike, and we don't want to see that again. The hospitals are already full. We have lots of COVID patients within every hospital in this state, and people, medical providers are tired. Several people have already left this field altogether as a consequence of COVID. And so we have fewer rooms available and fewer people to take care of people who contract COVID. And so anything we can do to prevent infections, which number one means getting that vaccine, number two, getting that booster, that's very, very important, especially at this time of year.
Dr. Hartman, thanks for joining us again today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Bill Hartman, assistant professor of anesthesiology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and medical director of the UW Health Pre-op Clinic, also principal investigator of the pediatric and adult vaccine trials at UW Health. We talked to him today about the Omicron variant of coronavirus.